morning. This is Radio Shalom coming to you from Planet FM. I have with me again Chris Harris. It was a pleasure talking to you last week, and I hope we're going to do the same this session. Last week, because it was such a vast and somber subject, the Holocaust, I didn't do my usual, which was tell a story, but I can't continue that forever. We have to have a story, because without a story, you can't concentrate, you can't, and the story is something to laugh about. So this is the story, and it's a little bit linked, and the story is about the current president of Iran. Do you know his name?
No, I can't
remember. It was Ahmadinejad, and then he was succeeded by, I forget his name. So let's call him Salam. So he calls the president of the United States, which in Iran, the United States is Satan, you know, the enemy, Satan. And he says to Donald Trump, he says, you know, I had a dream last night. And he says, yes. And he says, what's your dream? He says, well, my dream was that all the houses in America had a sign outside their houses on the walls, and everyone said, praised be Allah. So Donald Trump says, well, he says, you know, that's interesting. I also had a dream last night. And Hosania says, yeah, what was your dream? He says, well, I had the same dream. I dreamt that all the houses in Iran had a sign outside their front gate on the walls. And Hosani says, and who, what did the sign say? He says, I have no idea. I can't read Hebrew. So, Chris, we learned one thing in particular last week, and that was that I think I said history teaches us nothing, but you've given a lie to that, because you're studying the Holocaust and you're using the lessons of the Holocaust to improve our lives in the present, especially to stand up against abuse, to stand up against discrimination. So let's continue that.
Sure. I mean, it's really good to actually be back here, actually having a chat about this, because it is so important to all of us. And I think it's something that we have to take these lessons from the past and adapt them to now.
And we are.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just even being able to have this opportunity to be able to speak to so many people out there that, I mean, that may be actually saying, well, what can I do? Well, it's simple. It starts small. And that's just being able to actually say to somebody if they hear something that's wrong, and it's saying, look, this isn't appropriate. And I would ask you to actually refrain from actually saying it. And it's not being able to sort of just laugh and giggle at those little jokes that could be seen as actually offensive to someone. Mm-hmm. Because the more we're silent, the more we actually, you know, accept in regards to what the oppressor is actually doing.
And are you getting this on a one-on-one basis or in groups, schools?
Oh, I mean, we go from all sorts in regards to being able to, we hear it. I mean, that it could be an individual actually saying something to us at the centre, or it could be someone within a school group has actually said it. I mean, a lot of the time, I mean, when we look at school pupils, I mean, that they get a lot of those answers themselves, all those like snarky little comments that could be something that they've heard at home. And I think, you know, I mean, that we forget that, I mean, that if we raise our children to be able to actually say that it's okay to make fun of somebody because their race or their gender or sexual orientation, that, I mean, that if we just laugh about it and just think, oh, well, it's quite funny, then that's going to carry on in the classroom as well.
So how do you deal with that? Because I fully understand that kids in the class, they bring a lot of stuff, or they know a lot of stuff, that they get from their parents. So if a kid makes a remark in the class and you know that it comes from the parents, what do you, what can you do about that?
I think it's just mostly that, I mean, that saying to them, okay, that you say I can hear what you're trying to say from your parents' point of view, but in regards to where have they actually gathered that information from? And it's being able to say to the student to become that critical thinker. To be able to sit there and say, well, okay, my parents actually heard, from their parents, or they read it in a book which may be completely false, and being able to say to them, well, maybe you should actually look at two sides of the argument.
Right.
And actually really have an opinion in regards to that sort of thing. I mean, I got asked by one young man even at the beginning of this year when I was actually out on outreach, and he said to me, he said, oh, look, that the Holocaust never happened.
Right.
And I said to him, I said, where was your basis in regards to being able to tell me that the Holocaust never happened? And he said, well, it was simple. He said, I watched a documentary called The Conspiracy.
Yep.
And then I read a book that was actually written by David Irving.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, that's okay. I understand that. I mean, that's where you base your information on. But I said, it's very, very narrow. And you need to also know that, I mean, that primary evidence is the way that I'm going to argue you back.
Right.
Because I said that primary evidence is where we actually get our answers from. And I mean, we can, you can say that people doctor photos, and you can say that, I mean, people doctor in regards to documents and that sort of thing. But I mean, in reality, I mean, that when we're looking at millions upon millions of documents and millions upon millions of people that are witnesses to this, that's one huge conspiracy. And he said to me, he said, well, what do you have? So I actually produced him, which was a copy of a document that it actually was an invoice from Toft and Sons, which was a German company.
Yeah.
And it actually thanked in regards to the Nazi regime for payment, but also it explicitly said there, we hope that it meant that you enjoyed in regards to getting the crematoria ovens installed, that it meant that you requested, and that it meant that it has the available to be able to burn this many people per day. And I said to him, I said, look, I mean, that's a document that's come from the, you know, the late 1930s. I said, how do you actually argue that back? And he said, I can't. And I said, exactly. I said that.
Didn't he say that it's a forgery or it's made up?
I think that he finally got to the stage where it was just like, well, this actually really slapped me in the face in regards to it. It was so direct. And he said to me, he said, well, you know, is there many, many other documents out there? And I said, yeah, I said, there is many, many documents. So I led him to places like Yad Vashem, to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, to our website. And I said, just look, read through those documents and really sort of say to yourself, look, there's a consistent approach from every single one of these people about what they say and what they write. And he said, why do you say consistent? And I said, because if there's consistency, it means that it actually has a greater chance of actually being right. Right. I said, usually with conspiracies, there's people that come from multiple angles about one thing or another. And I said, if we look at 9/11, for example, you get those that say the Americans were behind it. You get those that say the Israelis were behind it. I said, but each one of them has a varied perspective on what they actually see. With the Holocaust, it's a consistency. And I said, that's something you can't argue back.
It's interesting. You started off the argument by producing one piece of evidence.
Yeah.
And there's millions of pieces of evidence.
Exactly.
So you started with one, and that got through.
Yeah. I was probably lucky, maybe. I don't know. But he soon changed his tone, and I heard from his teacher later on that, I mean, that he became a person that was actually starting to look more and more at these documents. Mm. And he was staying away from the photos, which was good. Because, I mean, that's where a lot of people will say that those things can be doctored. But he started actually reading paperwork. And he started reading diary entries. And from both sides as well. I said, don't always actually just focus on the victim. Focus and actually start seeing what others were writing, especially those that were actually the oppressors.
Yeah.
And actually read what they're actually saying. And when we look at people like Hans Stengel and what he actually writes, we look at in regards to the Commandant of Auschwitz, how he was forced to actually by the Allies to write his whole account of what it was like to be the Commandant.
Mm.
And I said, have a read of that one, because he actually blames all of his staff members, never blames himself, and never says that, I mean, that he had anything. He thought they were inefficient.
God.
Yeah, and I mean, we look at Auschwitz and think, how can you be inefficient in regards to it? But he felt that they were inefficient and weren't completing their job properly.
So his mission was nothing to do with human rights, nothing to do with morality, nothing to do with abuse. It was just doing my job.
Doing my job, yeah. And that's the thing, is that so many of them, and I mean, when we look at the accountant of Auschwitz, who says, all I was doing was counting money, but I mean, that the prosecution turned around and said, well, yes, you were counting money that would actually end up going and buying all the material that was required to actually fund these people to do what they needed to do. Don't tell me that you didn't have a direct involvement in this. I think that that's why, I mean, that it's really, really important that, I mean, that we're focusing on standing up and actually doing the right thing, because if we don't, we're going to get these people that are going to blame everybody else and create scapegoats for what might be actually happening within their own country or within their own communities as well.
This is not just a Second World War problem. I think it's a problem that's been going on for many years, many centuries, in many countries. And it's, I wish that countries would do what you're doing now, and that is learn from the past.
Yeah.
That'd be good.
I mean, we've seen Holocaust organisations that are trying their best in regards to it. But again, I mean, I think probably our isolation works a little bit easier for us. We're not battling against in regards to multiple political perspectives. We're not going against in regards to conservative nature that doesn't want to actually hear some of these things. And I think that that's been evident with when we actually launched that Children's Holocaust Memorial, which I talked about the week before, where we actually are seeing educational panels that, I mean, that students can come in and they can actually read basically what actually happened to the children during the time of the Holocaust. Read personal accounts. And I mean, every single one of those Children's Holocaust Memorial pictures that we've got down there has a link to New Zealand. And I think that that's really, really important, because we're seeing our history curriculum, our English curriculum, where teachers are actually saying, how can actually this event in history link to actually the significance of it to New Zealanders? And I think when kids have been coming in, I mean, we've only, because it's only just recently open, so we haven't actually had a large number of high school students or primary school or intermediate school students coming through. We have actually seen that those kids that have actually come through and gone, oh, so that person was actually born there, so they've actually got no connection to me. And then one of our educators will say, well, actually, their cousin actually only lives next door.
Right.
And they'll be like, what? And yeah, and she's a Holocaust survivor herself. And the students start to wake up and start to go, oh, well, actually, look actually how many people actually have a connection to us. And the teacher, they say, well, can we use that in projects? Can we use that in essays? And that sort of course, definitely. I mean, that's significant.
Absolutely. As soon as you make a connection, then it has some reality. It gets to you.
Exactly. And when you hear that, I mean, that our main logo is for our children's memorial is actually the cousin of Vera Egelmeyer, who is actually a well-known identity in the Wellington region as a Holocaust survivor. And, I mean, it's her cousin. And, I mean, she comes in sometimes and you see the photo of him and you see the photo of her and, you know, the splitting image, but the cousins, but they're more like brother and sister.
Wow.
And you see young people look and go, they look really the same. And when she starts talking to them, and you can see that they're like, wow, we've actually got a Holocaust survivor actually talking to us.
Right.
Who's actually sharing things. And I mean, that's what I talked about, you know, last week, was that the next generation is passing on the message. And you don't have to be directly involved. You don't have to be Jewish. You don't have to actually had Holocaust survivors within your family. You learn those stories and you pass those stories through. That's you learning, and that's other people that are actually following you learning that as well.
Absolutely.
And I think that that's vital for us. And I mean, training our teachers is one thing that works really, really well for us. But we just really want to just be able to just keep on going in regards to teaching our students more and more, educating our teachers, getting into our business community as well, because many of our business community are doing things around community projects, whether it's actually community participation, whether it's actually they have keywords, and it's for us to be able to turn to them and actually just say, look, what can we do? Can we come into your business and actually teach them about being this hashtag upstander?
Yeah.
And we would love that opportunity. So if anyone's listening, I mean, I'm willing to come, and I'm...
All those that are listening, please.
Yeah. Please, I mean, any organisation that you're part of, is please get in touch with me directly, and I would love to be able to actually come in and talk about how we can actually help you, whether it's in the classroom, the business, the community groups, because I think that the more and more people that we can actually influence, the more and more people that are actually going to become better people as a result of it as well.
I once asked Perry Trotter, when he started Shadows of Shoah, I said, what's in it for you? And he said, nothing. I said, why are you doing it? And he said, I believe that every person on the planet should know about the Holocaust.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's the world's greatest tragedy in regards to seeing 6 million murdered. Mm. We're seeing, you know, I mean, that the large, I think it was only just like in the last 18 months where we see the world's population actually of Jewish people return back to the population of what it was pre-1933. And you imagine that, I mean, it's taken that long for the population to actually regenerate itself. We're seeing that, I mean, that the Holocaust is something that, I mean, that is deeply ingrained in everything that we actually do.
Well, why do we earmark that as special or something catastrophic when the Second World War, there were, I think, 60 million people who died?
I think in some way that, I mean, that we rationale war, that, I mean, that countries attack countries, but this was actually a state-sanctioned, organised, industrial-scale murder. And I think that that's where people actually don't realise that, I mean, that this was not, this, they were not victims of war.
Well, war is not abuse.
No, victims of ideology. And that's the difference, is that, I mean, that there was a preconceived idea by the Nazis and their collaborators to be able to actually carry this act out. And I think that that's the big thing, is that there were people not just within Nazi Germany that wanted to carry this out. There were people that, I mean, that within Polish society. There were people in French society. There were people in Italy, Czech Republic.
Hungary.
I mean, Hungary, where we see that, I mean, that the Hungarian government actually paid the Nazis to be able to take their Jews. And, I mean, you know, that's disgusting in itself, that, I mean, that here, take them and then go and murder them. Mm. And we can't understand that unless we've actually got some direct connection to it. But, I mean, we can certainly learn about it.
Learn and not repeat.
Yeah.
Well, you know, those who are descendants of survivors, they know more about it. Those, like you mentioned, one kid who said that the Holocaust didn't take place, and then you showed him some evidence, those are the people that I think we need to get to.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And the thing is that, I mean, that we somehow some people in this world sort of think it, I mean, you know, I say that world when I say New Zealand, think that it's okay to be able to, like, I'm going to a fancy dress party, so I'm going to splash on a swastika.
Yeah.
And I'm going to dress up as a Nazi today. And people think that it's okay. Or the recent account where we had the young man last year that was dressed in striped pajamas with a gold star on him and, you know, with Judah written in it. And,
yeah,
you know, and to be able to parade around his school, yes, before he was actually sent home to change, but he still had that rationale to do something like that. And, I mean, that we get, not all the time, but we actually sometimes get comments made to us, and highly offensive comments, and not have a place in society, but people think that it's actually funny. That mean that, oh, well, look at the Nazis, I'll dress up like one, and everybody will think that, what am I doing coming to a fancy dress? Oh, yeah, that's cool. Everybody thinks, oh, what a great uniform you've actually got, where it's like, well, think about what that uniform actually symbolises.
So how do you get to them? I mean, the school actually sent this person to go and change?
Yeah, I mean, I think the school sent him because he was just part of a big school group who were listening to me, and he was just one of the vocal ones. The problem is that sometimes it's not the vocal ones that you have to worry about. It's those ones that are sitting there feasting on things and going, oh, no, I don't believe anything that he's actually saying. But all we can do is to actually do our best and actually say, look, if you actually hear this sort of stuff around school, you do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you act upon it. You don't say, oh, it's okay, it's just a joke. I mean, if we hear, you know, racial abuse around school, do we sit there and actually do nothing? Well, I'd hope that we don't. So I think that anything to do with any sort of abuse or discrimination, you know, I mean, I used to have students who would say, oh, you know, class is gay today. And I'd be like, well, mm-hmm. do you understand what you're actually trying to say that? And then when you actually tell them in regards to it, I said, of all the words that you could have chosen something else. And, you know, I said, just think about how offensive that could be to somebody within this classroom.
Absolutely. Well,
Yeah, so I think that'd mean that for us, that'd mean that we're going forward, we're making progress, we're next year, you know, we want this hashtag Upstander to really actually be something that, I mean, that really defines who we are. We want to be able to get that social justice. We want a lot of people coming along. I mean, please, you know, I mean, that if you hear about it, please do come along and support the centre, but also just learn. And I think that's the biggest thing, is learn and actually ask questions, meet these people, talk about events, get to know what we do actually at the Holocaust Centre, that we're not just focused on the Holocaust, we're focused on human rights advocacy, we're talking about social justice. And I think that's really, really important in regards to anybody just to be able to listen to and engage with.
It's vital. It's vital.
Yeah, it is. And we've got the Children's Memorial. It's not going to stay in Wellington past April. It'll make its way to Christchurch after that. And we're just negotiating with one place up here. We're hoping that, I mean, that we can actually get this into MOTAT as well.
Yeah.
Starting in August, but if we can't, we're going to be having to look at other options. Unfortunately, with Auckland Museum, it's going through a redevelopment. And but I mean that if anybody out there does have a venue that, I mean, that they can think of that would be central, I mean, I'd be love to hear from them, because we would really, really like this memorial to come to Auckland. It has a vital part. There's a large Jewish community within the Auckland community. And we think that, I mean, that...
So what kind of a venue? Like a museum?
Like a museum, or just even just like an art gallery somewhere that, I mean, that, or a decent-sized library or something that, I mean, that is central, that, I mean, that can hold this, but also be able to have the educational material that it goes up with it as well. And it's just somewhere that, I mean, that can hold, you know, 1.5 million buttons within these series of ascending small boxes that go from the individual all the way up to the largest one, which is 2.36 metres. So you walk underneath it and all you are covered in is perspex and buttons. I think that, that, you know, I mean, that sort of experience, you know, is so amazingly out of proportion that you just can't believe in regards to what you're seeing in front of you, that, I mean, that this large scale is actually full to the top.
So you need a large scale kind of public
spot. I mean,
public spot.
And that's the thing, is that we're seeing a large number of people that are just coming off the street to be able to view this and actually look around it. It's creating an emotional response as well, that, I mean, that some people look at it and walk out, others will ponder and sit there and think about connections that they may have. Or we had a lady that came up to us the other day who actually said, my father was actually one of the ones who actually liberated Bergen-Belsen.
Right.
And I said, oh, how do you feel about being here? And she said, I can understand what he must have actually looked through. She said it must have been very, very hard for him to be able to actually open the gates of Bergen-Belsen and see that.
General Eisenhower, when the war was won, and he went round concentration camps, he told the press, he said, take as many pictures as you can, because there will be deniers. We need evidence.
Definitely. And that's the thing, and I think that's the same with any sort of genocide or any sort of thing, is that the evidence has to speak for itself.
Yep.
And I think that that's the big thing, is when you're communicating with students who have been rude or disrespectful in some way, if you just say, oh, you said something, there's nothing there. But if you've actually got something concrete, you can really act upon it.
Let's talk a bit about Steven Spielberg.
Yes.
He had this worldwide interview of survivors. I know my daughter actually was one of the people who did interview, and she said it was pretty tough. She did. And one of the people who was a survivor, and I said to him, can my daughter interview? And he said, no.
Okay.
And I said, why not even? And he said, I was in Auschwitz. I survived. And he said, I spent my whole life trying to forget. And he said, I just can't talk about it.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is that, I mean, that it's interesting when you look at survivors, that you get some that really, really want to talk.
Mm.
Some who don't. They actually put it down to, is that the Meryl Streep miniseries that was done in the 1970s called Holocaust.
Yeah.
They said that that was probably the launching pad for a lot of survivors around the world to actually talk about their experiences, because it was in their homes. And they would sit there and they'd watch it. And then I remember talking to one where he talked about his father sitting there, and he was like 9, and he was sitting there watching it with his father, and then his father said, "No, that's not how the camps were." And the son turned around and said, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah. Well, it wasn't like that when I was there." And so I think that that's a real interesting one. But Steven Spielberg has really opened the door for Holocaust education by doing this. I mean, it's just been released on December the 7th again in the United States. It's its 25th anniversary. Spielberg, actually, I listened to a webinar last week, and he was actually talking about in regards to relaunching this, and he's actually changed the trailer of it as well. And they said, "How have you changed the trailer?" And he said, "Well, I've actually sort of incorporated that the world actually needs this movie."
The world needs the movie?
Yeah, he said this world right now needs this movie, he said, because of the world that we're living in right now.
Yeah.
And he talked about taking his crew to places like Krakow. And he said, "I had to take psychologists with me because they had to deal with the crew, because the crew were so traumatized by what they were actually doing, that they were filming on the streets where these events actually happened." I've been lucky enough to actually meet 3 Schindler Jews myself when I've been in Israel. And I mean, that their experiences and what they talk about Oskar Schindler and the work that he actually did was just, it's so enriching to be able to actually listen to these people talk about their lives. And I always remember watching the movie for the first time and seeing the little girl who talks about cleaning out the bullets with her little fingers, and to actually meet that little girl.
Wow.
Is truly special. Ava is an amazing person, and she's my Facebook friend now, so she spends more time on Facebook than I do.
Amazing.
Yeah, she and I, when I went to Poland this year, I actually walked around Schindler's factory, and they had a photo of her.
Yes.
And so I took the photo and sent it through her through Messenger, and I said, "Weren't you a cute little thing?" And she said, "Yeah, lots have changed since then."
Oh, Chris, I got tears in my eyes. How old is she now?
I'm not sure how old Ava would be now. I mean, what are we looking at? She's probably early 80s, I would imagine. 80s? Yep.
That's amazing.
Husband and wife that actually were Schindler Jews as well.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they weren't husband and wife at that time, but he said, you know, we were the perfect pair. You know, she had the pot, I had the handle, so we actually came together nicely in the factory.
Yeah.
And they'd been married for 16, well, they'd be on the 26th, I think, of January next year. They will be married for 69 years.
69.
Yeah. And, I mean, unbelievable, lovely people. And, I mean, that's the thing, is that, I mean, these survivors have this exuberance for life, this youth that, I mean, that, and this drive that, I mean, that you talk about Holocaust education, and they're just like, "Chris, thank you." And I said, no, you don't have to thank me. This is something that I love to do.
That's another subject, hey. We can talk about life and death and why people have this lust for life after survival from the concentration camps.
For sure. And that's the thing, is that, I mean,
it's amazing.
It's a topic that, I mean, I don't think people realise, is that look at the things that they've achieved. And, I mean, we look at, you know, I mean, one who's a professor of microbiology, you know, retired policeman, said to him, "What do you like doing in your spare time?" And he said, "I like to rock climb an abseil." And he was in his early 80s. I was like, wow, I'm in my mid-40s and I'm worried about in regards to what I can do, and he's doing all of these things. So, yeah, it's great to actually see that passion and that drive that, I mean, that still continues to actually resonate.
After overcoming the trauma.
Oh, for sure. The thing is that, I mean, it's an unbelievable drive.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's been.
We have some in this country who've survived, and they have that unbelievable passion for life.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
I talk about, you know, Bob and Fred and Nairuf.
Yeah.
I mean.
Soul.
Yeah.
What in Suna?
You know.
Filler. Soul filler.
We get people like Inga Wolf.
Yeah.
You know, the director of our center, Stephen Sedley. Yeah.
Well, Chris, that was fascinating. And I repeat, education is the best tool that you have to change the world. Thank you for coming. Thank you to you listeners for listening. And John, get better. And thank you to our sponsor, Nature Bee. Talk again next time.
Thank you.
Thanks. Cheers.